Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, it's lights, camera,
action!
We take our seats to explore how cities are shown on screen. From the Hollywood Hills to London and beyond, the built environment proves much more than a bit part in many of our favourite fictional classics. On today's show, we also look at the world of science fiction and its predictions for how we'll live in the future, as well as eyeing some recent releases for novel ideas on urban living.
A lot of science fiction writers are really interested in testing the directions in which human society can evolve. And if you're going to do that, you have to think about the role of cities.
We also take a trip to the world's hottest tourist spots to find out how starring in a feature film has elevated some destinations to very new heights. Plus, you've cast your leading role, but how do you cast a city?
Filmmakers, set designers, and screenwriters have long known the power of a setting to make us feel something.
That's all coming up right now on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's show. A film can often be as famous for its setting as it is for its cast of characters or storyline. Just think how different King Kong would have been had the great ape been swatting fighter planes while clinging to the Eiffel Tower or the Burj Khalifa. Or what about if Robert De Niro had been driving a black cab rather than a New York taxi in the 1976 classic Taxi Driver?
You're talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
Science fiction films are no exception. But when your story takes place in the future, the look and feel of an existing city can become a new strange place in the hands of writers, set designers, and directors. So, what can we learn from these fanciful depictions of our own urban environments? Will the transport issues of today be solved by taking to the sky in flying vehicles? How can we embrace the best of the cinematic utopia while avoiding a fate similar to a Mad Max Thunderdome?
Two men enter, one man leaves.
Well, a little bit earlier, I spoke with Carl Abbott, Professor Emeritus of Urban Studies and Planning at Portland State University, and author of Imagined Frontiers, a collection of essays that deal with the future frontiers of science fiction. And I began by asking him where his fascination for the sci-fi depiction of the urban realm came from.
It combines two of my fundamental interests, which is science fiction, which I've been a science fiction reader since I was a kid, and I've kept it up as an adult, considering it's, you can read science fiction at many levels. So I've always been interested in science fiction. I've written a fair amount about it. And then I've made my living for 40 years or so teaching urban studies and urban planning. So the combo seems pretty natural.
Well, you say something which I think is true for even people who don't have the wealth of knowledge that you have, which is that Blade Runner, whenever you talk to people about the depictions of cities in science fiction, people come back to this notion of Blade Runner. Why is it, do you think, that it's caught people's imagination as the most interesting example of this notion of unpacking urbanism on the screen?
I think Blade Runner really catches the imagination, partly because it's really visually pretty stunning. The opening scenes with the flying cars over the huge buildings and the flares shooting up is a kind of dystopian view of New York gone super bad. And then at the same time, it zeroes in on the street level. So you get a sense of the city as this huge megastructure. And then, you know, as Harrison Ford is pursuing his investigations, you get the sense of the city as a real place where real people can live. So I think it really picks up two different ways of thinking about things. And just also, it's a cool story. And again, I think great visual design.
And do you think it's because it's not a fantasy city? It's, you know, it's based on Los Angeles, and it's kind of based on what the writers were thinking Los Angeles in their version would be like now, which thankfully, or I think thankfully, we haven't got to. But is there something, because it has a real connection with a real city as well, that it has this cut through?
I think so. And, you know, another film, that a very different science fiction film Soylent Green, which is set in a future New York that looks very much like present-day New York, except even grubbier. That, too, I think, caught people's imagination because they could picture a future like that because it was based in a city that people knew.
Now, you slightly upend people's perceptions, though, and you've hinted that there are different ways of seeing this film, but you did yourself use the word dystopian. But actually, what's fascinating is when you talk about Blade Runner, you see many positives in the city that has got to be known and kind of loved on screen. What are the things that you saw in the film that you thought were actually positives about making a city?
Blade Runner has a really kind of active street life. It's a multi-ethnic city. It recognized, in a sense, the fact of Los Angeles, even when the film was made, as a multi-ethnic city, and even more so now. It's a street life in which you see the vibrancy that mixing of people and ideas can bring. It has a classic sleazy bar that any noir movie should have. So it gives you the feel of a place that you could actually live in. Now, admittedly, there's some things about it. For whatever reason, they decided to make future Los Angeles rainy, which there is a rainy season, but still a little odd choice. But when people interviewed people about the movie, just sort of general viewers, they actually say, well, that might be kind of an interesting place to live.
What's interesting, I guess, is that most times you fear these kind of films won't show a kind of a city where kind of cultural synthesis happens. They'll be homogenous in their kind of view of the kinds of people that live in the cities. But in Blade Runner, you see Asian women as the stars of commercials and adverts on the sides of buildings. There's Hare Krishnas, there's Jewish people, all sorts of people come up in the film. And that takeaway about what a contemporary Los Angeles is today and what this kind of fantasy version of it, science fiction version of it rather, is, do you see some kinds of echoes between what's reality and what was shown in the film?
Oh, I think very much so. I mean, it's actually kind of ironic that the street scenes in Blade Runner were actually shot on a movie set that was the old New York movie set from previous movies that was just then redecorated and redressed to make it look like a future Los Angeles, which shows you the power of movie making. But that's also, I think, tied into the sense of the Blade Runner city as a real place, a place that people, again, you might or might not want to live in it, but it really had the sense of a real Los Angeles.
That's Carl Abbott, and we'll return to our chat a little bit later in the show. But first, a bit of set jetting. This novel term refers to set-based sightseeing. You only have to consider New Zealand's association with The Lord of the Rings to understand how much the cinema can spark a tourism boom. Recent films such as Mamma Mia and Crazy Rich Asians have created fresh interest in their filming locations for movie-mad travellers. But while some centres embrace the added attention a motion picture can bring, others find the activity all too much to handle. Rosie Spinks is a reporter for Quartzy, the lifestyle edition of QZ.com, and flew through our Midori House HQ here in London to give us a full rundown of the world of set jetting.
Set jetting is this phenomenon whereby people travel to a destination somewhere motivated by seeing it in a film or on a TV show. And it's not necessarily a new phenomenon, but we've really seen an uptick in it at the moment. So the most prominent set jetting example at the moment is Game of Thrones, and there's a few places where that's going on, Croatia and also Iceland. And sort of coincidentally, both of those countries have seen a huge uptick in tourism in general. So it's sort of easy to say, oh, well, it's because of Game of Thrones that Iceland's tourism has exploded in the past, 5 to 10 years. It's a bit more complicated than that, but surely it's sort of contributing to the hype around those destinations.
Let the monsters kill each other. And while they battle in the north, we take back the lands that belong to us.
Another example is the second film of Mamma Mia, which is filmed on the Croatian island of Vis. There was a similar effect in the first film, which was in Greece. So the second film is in Croatia. And apparently the residents of Skopelo were a bit miffed that the second film was not also filmed there.
I have never felt closer to Mom. I'm in the exact same place that she was all those years ago.
You're pregnant.
Yeah, I am.
I think that oftentimes one of the conflicts here is that the people who are tasked with attracting visitors, i.e. the tourism board, are not necessarily the same people who are tasked with managing that influx of tourism. So in the case of, you know, New Zealand, that push to bring tourists for Lord of the Rings tourism was really backed by the tourism board. It's not always so popular with the locals. So a sort of integrated tourism system in a country is always going to be a better bet when it comes to understanding, okay, if we attract people here, we also need to be taking steps to make sure that it doesn't affect the quality of life of people who actually live here.
Thank you for embarking upon your journey with Air New Zealand. May your path always be guided by the light of the stars, and may the future bestow upon you all the happiness and adventure our Middle Earth has to offer.
That's a wrap, everyone.
In terms of tourism boards and locations sort of incentivizing filming, I think that's always been a bit of a trend. You know, Cape Town has always been a hotspot for films and even photo shoots just because it's cheaper to film there. I don't personally know of anywhere that's asking, you know, popular films and trilogies and stuff like that to film, but I would not be surprised to know that that's happening. One location that's just taking off right now would be Singapore, and you might think, well, people already travel to Singapore, but off the back of the huge success of Crazy Rich Asians, the tourism board there is very much piggybacking off of trying to position the city as a sort of luxury place to visit and lavish in everything it has to offer. So we've seen a lot of activation there in terms of inviting journalists to write travel pieces, and they were sort of involved in the premiere of the film in Singapore, so that I definitely would not be surprised to see Singapore's tourism on the uptick after that.
Singapore, Colin's wedding. Don't you want to be my family?
I hardly know anything about them. Every time I bring them up, it changes the subject. Maybe his parents are poor and he has to send them money.
I'll take a bag and get you checked into first class.
The example of set-jetting tourism that's often pointed to at the moment as a negative is Dubrovnik and Croatia in general. I think that one's a tough one because there's a lot of other factors that are contributing to the sort of crisis of over-tourism that places like Dubrovnik and Barcelona and Reykjavik are facing. And I think that we can't blame any one factor. And if we are, we should certainly look at larger structural ones like low-cost airfare, cruise ships. You know, people are making money every time a cruise ship offloads several thousand people into an ancient city. And that's certainly, I think, having a bigger impact that we could talk about than, you know, people motivated by watching Game of Thrones. In the broader question of overtourism, taking it a little broader than set jetting, there certainly are places where that's happening. Barcelona has really sort of impressive and rigorous restrictions on Airbnb now. And Venice, which is another sort of example of overtourism, is in the coming months diverting cruise ships from being able to approach the city. So I really think that's beginning. And I don't necessarily think it's pushing back against tourism in general. I think it's a better management of tourism. You know, we've had this amazing democratization of travel, but alongside that, we haven't really had authorities and governments that know how to handle things like Airbnb or flights that cost, you know, under £100. So we're sort of getting to a point where some cities are catching up to that reality. And unfortunately, it's a bit late, but it's encouraging to see that it is possible.
That was Rosie Spinks, reporter for Quartzy, and this is The Urbanist. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. This week, looking at the world of cities on screen. We return now to our interview with urbanist and historian Carl Abbott, discussing how science fiction depicts the cities of the future. I wanted to put the often debated world of Blade Runner aside for a moment to look at some other depictions of future cities in film. So I asked Carl what it is about the city that is so intriguing to science fiction writers.
The city is the place where ideas happen. It's always been the place where new ideas happen. In some science fiction, obviously, the city is just a pure backdrop or setting. In the Star Wars movies, Coruscant is kind of big and flashy, but you don't get any feel for the actual place. But a lot of science fiction writers are really interested in testing the directions in which human society can evolve. And if you're going to do that, you have to think about the role of cities.
Now, one of the other pieces that you look at is Nalo Hopkinson's Brown Girl in the Ring from 1998. Now, this looks at a future Toronto. And as you explain in your piece, it's a Toronto kind of a bit like a Detroit, where the role of government has slightly collapsed and the world of capitalism has kind of failed a little bit. And the residents are kind of left to do as best they can. Again, did you see this as a critique of what's happened in the likes of Detroit turning its story around now? But did you see this as a critique of those failures of government in those big Rust Belt cities, for example?
I think it pretty clearly was a critique of that kind of thing, that it was a critique of worry about the future of a place like Toronto from the point of view of somebody being part of the ethnic community within Toronto when she was writing. At the same time, it's a story in which the characters in the novel are pretty much left on their own to create their own social institutions. And I think that Hopkinson was drawing on a lot of the ideas about sociologists who studied improvised settlements in developing countries, who found lots and lots of self-organization and social structure that just isn't the formal governmental and official formal structure. So I think she's seeing the part of Toronto she writes about as another third world city where people are actually taking care of things.
So tell me, do you think these books and films are good at hinting how cities will be in the future? For example, in Blade Runner, there are many scenes of flying vehicles. And now we're coming back to the idea that some companies are thinking this potentially could happen in the coming years. Are they good predictors?
I don't think that science fiction is terribly good at predicting. You can project trends, but I think we all know that simply projecting a trend is dangerous because you don't know what unexpected event is lurking out there 10 or 20 years into the future. So I think science fiction is actually much better at commenting on the present. And you see this, you see the themes, you see science fiction during the Cold War commenting very heavily on international tensions and the dangers of nuclear war. And now there's lots and lots of science fiction that in one way or another is taking on climate change, projecting alternative futures about climate change. And probably none of the specific projections will be right, but getting people to think about the issue, getting people to think about what it would be like if the American Southwest totally dries up, or if New York City is half drowned. Getting people to think about those issues in a way that perhaps is not quite as threatening as the current question of, do we want a carbon tax or not? Thinking through a little bit more deeply what consequences of current actions might be.
And do you think there are, on the other hand, some ideas that maybe you've seen in science fiction that you think might make a positive change to the way that our cities are run and organized?
There's an earlier book by Stan Robinson called Pacific Edge. It's set in Orange County, California, which is not necessarily the most utopian setting, but it's a way of imagining what in a changing world in which their resources are somewhat more constrained, how people reorganize themselves around smaller scale communities. So it's not back to the past by any means, but it's providing extra layers of public involvement at the neighborhood and community level and imagining how that simply what that kind of world might look like. So I see that as a very utopian way of thinking about possible futures.
A big thank you there to Carl Abbott, Professor Emeritus at Portland State University. Finally, on today's show, we enlisted the help of Monocle 24's eminent film expert for this special report. As viewers, we've become used to seeing As It Is reflected on the silver screen, from the gritty realism of Martin Scorsese's New York to the elegant mystique of Alfred Hitchcock's London. But while these movies often take place in carefully constructed fictional depictions of the places we know, could they teach real-life city planners a thing or two about their craft? Monocle's Ben Rylan investigates.
A distinct chill has descended upon the city of Budapest. It's the late 1930s and the threat of war looms over the employees of Maracek and Company, a small leather goods and gift shop. But their concerns are more immediate. Friends, family, love. And the chill? Well, that's all part of the average Hungarian winter. Based on a play by Miklos Laszlo, The Shop Around the Corner stars James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan as two bickering co-workers who, unbeknownst to each other, have been exchanging letters and are on the way to falling in love.
My heart was trembling as I walked into the post office, and there you were lying in box 237. I took you out of your envelope and read you right there.
Though the film takes place in Budapest, it was, in reality, shot on the MGM studio backlot in Los Angeles. Stewart and Sullivan speak in their usual American accents, as does a charming Frank Morgan in the role of the shop's owner, Mr. Maracek. In fact, the film's German director, Ernst Lubitsch, does very little to convince us that the action is indeed taking place in Budapest. That's because, being one of the screen's great sophisticates, he knew that a film's setting was only effective when it carried the power to make an audience feel something. His Budapest is a city of snow, streetlights, and loneliness that, for much of its American audience, must have seemed a world away.
You mean you're all alone in Budapest on Christmas Eve?
That's right.
Rudy, do you like chicken noodle soup?
When Christmas arrives, however, and James Stewart slowly falls for Margaret Sullivan, the people of Mr. Maracek's shop come to realize the spirit of company and community.
Oh, Mr. Maracek.
And then a double order of apple strudel with vanilla sauce.
Sounds wonderful.
Nearly 60 years later, the story once again arrived on screens with a new name, a new means of communication, and a new city.
I would send you a bouquet of newly sharpened pencils if I knew your name and address. On the other hand, this not knowing has its charms.
Before Tinder economized the art of electronic dating and social media wrecked the world, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan managed to make the internet seem somehow sweetly romantic in one of the screen's great romantic comedies, You've Got Mail.
What is that? What are you doing? What is that? What are you doing? You're taking all the caviar? That caviar is a garnish.
Paper, envelopes, and stamps were recast as online chat rooms, and pre-war Budapest became pre-9/11 New York City, specifically the Upper West Side. The list of films that have cast Manhattan as a backdrop is endless, but here, director Nora Ephron isn't just leaning on the city as a ready-made, recognizable set piece. By carving off her own small section and restricting almost all of the action to a very specific area, Ephron gives us a version of New York that feels more like a quaint village. Like its predecessor, the film is, on paper, a romance between two sworn enemies who don't realize that they've already fallen in love with each other. And yet, on a deeper level, there's a more complex argument being made here. Kathleen Kelly, played by Meg Ryan, owns a small neighborhood bookstore, aptly titled The Shop Around the Corner, who discovers that Fox Books, a big corporate bookseller run by Joe Fox, played by Tom Hanks, is opening a superstore right around the corner.
A Fox Books superstore.
Kel nightmare.
It has nothing to do with us. It's big, impersonal, overstocked, and full of ignorant salespeople.
But they discount.
But they don't provide any service. We do.
Kelly believes, or at least wants to believe, that loyalty and her community's appreciation for what her store represents will keep her customers coming back. Her boyfriend, Frank, a left-wing writer for the New York Observer, offers to write a column defending Hirschhoff's battle against a corporate future. Played as a liberal caricature by Greg Kinnear, he shuns the emergence of computers and online culture in favor of the gentle hum of an electric typewriter.
The Olympia Report Deluxe Electric Report. As in gunshot.
But economic realities soon start creeping through the cracks of this New York fantasy, and there are hints that this Hollywood ending won't be quite as sweet as the first time around. One scene involving a protest features an eerily prescient line from Meg Ryan's character.
Do you want the West Side to become one big, gigantic strip mall?
No!
Do you want to get off the subway at 72nd and Broadway and not even know you're in New York City?
No!
Can we save the shop around the corner?
That intersection, 72nd and Broadway, is now home to a discount Bloomingdale's, a Trader Joe's supermarket, and a Bank of America. You've Got Mail is built upon the idea that it's not enough just to love something or someone. You've got to do something about it. Whether it's Joe Fox discovering that his secret online pen pal is also his very public business enemy, or Kathleen Kelly's customers, who claim to love their borough and promise that they'll keep coming back to the shop around the corner, even when they won't. Efron is challenging her characters and us. We may like the way that a quaint neighborhood shop makes us feel, but the economics of communities and small business are much more complex than feelings. The decline of retail in New York and elsewhere is a real problem. There are less shops in New York today than there were in 2001. Several reports show the number of vacant shops in key areas rising. As much as 14% are said to be empty along Columbus Avenue on the Upper West Side, where You've Got Mail was filmed. Some critics say that less retail doesn't necessarily equal empty properties. Storefronts are often repurposed. But the closure of a local shop, whether it's a cafe, bakery, newsagent, or bookstore, often has a significant impact on its community and the neighborhood by encouraging people to venture elsewhere and, well, generally making the whole area just less nice. You've Got Mail wouldn't have carried quite the same appeal had Meg Ryan's bookstore been rewritten as an overpriced gym and paleo bar. Filmmakers, set designers, and screenwriters have long known the power of a setting to make us feel something. The coziness of New York in You've Got Mail, the chilly optimism of Budapest in The Shop Around the Corner. So, if cities are our real-life sets, how do we want them to make us feel? And, as Nora Ephron might have put it, what are we willing to do about it?
A star turn there by our own in-house cinephile, Ben Rylan. And now it's time for the closing credits, I'm afraid, of this week's episode of The Urbanist. First of all, remember to pick up the latest copy, though, of Monocle magazine for more stories from the world of urbanism, culture, and everything besides. You can get your copy at any good newsstand now. Also, be sure to join us for a special live edition of The Urbanist to mark the official launch of our new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. It's taking place on the 31st of October with a panel of experts who will be joining me on stage here at Midori House in London to unpack some of the publication's core themes. Tickets include a copy of the book as well as a few drinks, so why not come along? All details can be found at monocle.com, and I look forward to seeing you. The show, well, it had two big-name producers, Carlotta Rabello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. Now there's a real star turn. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Kool and the Gang with Hollywood Swinging. Thank you for listening, city lovers. Hey, hey, hey. What you got to say?